Hello and welcome back to UEG Journal Podcast, your quick dive into the latest and most impactful research in gastroenterology. I am Dr. Mohsin Subhani, Training Associate Editor of UEG Journal and hepatologist based at University Hospital Nottingham.
And I'm Maria Manuela Espinho, Trainee Associate Editor of the UEG Journal and a gastroenterologist and assistant professor in Portugal.
We are back for the latest episode, and we have picked out five outstanding articles from the latest issue of UEG Journal.
And as always, we'll keep it short and sharp. In under 20 minutes, we'll walk you through the key takeaways and what they might mean for your day-to-day clinical practice.
So grab a coffee and join us for a fast and well-focused roundup of what is new in GI research. We will start with a latest guideline related to gallbladder polyps, titled as Revised Guideline for the Treatment and Follow-up of Gallbladder Polyps, Do Not Reduce Unwarranted Cholecystectomy. The guideline was proposed by Mike van Doreen and colleagues based in Netherlands.
We see gallbladder polyps all the time. Usually, they are found incidentally on ultrasound. Mostly, they are benign, but it's hard to know which ones really matter. Modern imaging still can't reliably tell us those that are benign and distinguish from those that are malignant. So, diagnosis is only certain after removal and histology.
Current guidelines recommend cholecystectomy for any polyp over 1 centimeter, but that is probably too cautious. The risk of cancer in this polyps is less than 0.4%. Risk goes higher in polyps of size greater than 2 centimeter. A recent cohort study of over 600,000 patients published in JAMA Gastroheb found no increased risk of cancer in people with gallbladder polyps, those without gallbladder polyps.
This Dutch multicenter study analyzed 302 patients with gallbladder polyps from 26 hospitals, comparing the 2017-2022 European guidelines. The 2022 update mainly changed the age risk factor from 50 to 60 years old.
In the current study, patients were followed up for a median of 23 months with about 3 imaging studies each. Overall, 29% underwent cholecystectomy after roughly 2 years. Using 2017 guidelines, 81% of these surgeries met the criteria, whereas based on 2022 guidelines, 77% met the guideline for a cholecystectomy. Interestingly, there was only a difference of 3 cases.
Yes, and the pathology results were telling. Of those operated, 69% had non-neoplastic polyps and 32% had no abnormality at all. Indeed, only 6 patients, corresponding to 9%, had adenomas, 3 of which had low-grade dysplasia and 1 with high-grade dysplasia. No invasive cancers were found.
So even after revising the guidelines, unnecessary surgery remains common. Authors suggest moving beyond simple size and age cutoff to include imaging morphology or contrast-enhanced features to better predict the risk of cancer in gallbladder polyps.
Yes, so in short, gallbladder polyps are frequent, but cancer is rare. Our current follow-up and surgical thresholds still lead to overtreatment.
Gallbladder polyps are often harmless. In this large Dutch cohort, almost a third of the patients underwent surgery, yet only 1 in 10 had an adenoma and none had cancer. Updating European guidelines from 2017 to 2022 only changed a little. It's a time for comprehensive imaging-based risk stratification to avoid unnecessary cholecystectomies in this cohort.
And with that, let's move from the gallbladder to the pancreas. Our next paper explores the long-term efficacy and safety of digital single-operator video pancreatoscopy-guided lithotripsy for pancreatic duct stones, a very different but equally fascinating area. Over the last decade, digital single-operator video pancreatoscopy has emerged as an alternative. It does allow direct visualization and electrohydraulic lithotripsy of pancreatic stones under endoscopic control. However, long-term data have been limited.
This multicenter retrospective study by Conard and colleagues included 58 patients with chronic calcifying pancreatitis who underwent single-use video pancreatoscopy guided lithotripsy between 2015 and 2022 across 5 tertiary centers. All had prior technical and clinical success and were followed up for 24 months.
The baseline mean pain score on the numerical rating scale was around 6.1, which dropped to 1.5 at 3 months, a reduction of more than 50% in 89% of the patients. Long-term clinical success, meaning sustained pain reduction at 24 months, was maintained in 71% of the patients.
Complete ductal clearance was achieved in 79%, usually after a single session. This appeared to be key determinant of lasting pain control. Importantly, adverse events occurred in 26%, mainly mild to moderate post-ERCP pancreatitis in about 1/5 of the patients.
Interestingly, quality of life scores didn't change significantly. The physical component score stayed at around 45 and the mental score near 50, suggesting that while pain improves, other factors like disease-related disability still continue to limit the quality of life of these patients.
Authors conclude that digital single-operative video pancreatoscopy-guided lithotripsy is a safe and effective endoscopic option for chronic calcifying pancreatitis when complete ductal clearance is achieved, but future studies are required to compare with other available techniques for pancreatic lithotripsy.
So the message is, for patients with obstructing pancreatic duct stones, direct vision lithotripsy achieves durable pain relief in most cases with acceptable safety. However, the quality of life of these patients may depend on broader management of chronic pancreatitis.
And with that, let's move on from the pancreas to liver. Our next paper identifies key predictor of relevant weight loss in patients with metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease, a topic with major implication for everyday hepatology and general practice. This multicenter iterative study by Pugliese and colleagues included over 900 patients with MASLD, and these were followed up for 21 months over 4 tertiary centers. Lifestyle was standardized, focusing on diet and physical activity, and outcomes were reassessed after roughly 2 years.
Yes, and despite consistent counseling, only about 18% of patients managed to lose at least 7% of their baseline weight. And this 7% is the percentage that is usually defined as clinically relevant weight loss. Still, this is a very important group to study because even modest reductions in body weight have been shown to improve steatosis, inflammation, and fibrosis.
Exactly. The authors ran multivariable analysis to identify independent predictor of this success. They found baseline BMI of greater than 30 was a strong predictor with odds ratio of greater than 2 for achieving more than 7% body weight loss. Interestingly, support from a nutritionist doubled the likelihood of success, and GLP-1 receptor agonist use also increased odds by nearly twofold. Two biological markers stood out, and they were bilirubin of greater than 1.2 milligram per deciliter or a liver stiffness measure of greater than 10 kilopascals. Both were independently associated with greater weight loss, possibly reflecting better metabolic engagement or greater disease awareness.
And these findings are quite revealing. Only 1 in 5 patients actually worked with a nutritionist, yet a subgroup achieved much higher success rates. This reinforces how structured lifestyle support combined with pharmacological tools like GLP-1 agonists can make a real difference in MASLD management. And that link with elevated bilirubin, the likely mild elevations consistent with Gilbert syndrome, is intriguing. It fits with data suggesting bilirubin's antioxidant and metabolic regulatory roles might confer protection against metabolic dysfunction.
The key take-home message for me from this study is meaningful weight loss in MASLD remains difficult to achieve, but patients with high BMI at the start with structural nutrition support and a GLP-1 therapy on board could do better. In addition, elevated bilirubin or liver stiffness could be used as a personalized feedback to induce behavior change and supplement the weight loss. In addition, dietary support with specific low-carb diet can be helpful.
Absolutely. Tailoring lifestyle and pharmacologic strategies to the individual patient profile seems key for the long-term outcomes in MASLD.
And now let's move to our next paper, which discusses IBIS SAS in highly accurate intestinal ultrasound score for predicting endoscopic disease activity in ulcerative colitis. This was written by a well-known group from Germany.
So let's start by explaining what the IBIS SAS actually is. IBIS SAS stands for International Bowel Ultrasound Segmental Activity Score. It's a standardized scoring system developed by the IBIS group to quantify inflammation seen on intestinal ultrasound.
Quite right, Manuela. Intestinal ultrasound is gaining attention because it's non-invasive, widely available, and can be done repeatedly without much discomfort, unlike the endoscopy, which remains the gold standard but requires bowel preparation, sedation, and patient coming to hospital for short stay and having the procedure done.
Yes, and that's where the IBIS SAS comes in. It combines four key ultrasound features: bowel wall thickness, blood flow or vascularization, loss of bowel wall stratification, and inflammatory fat changes around the bowel. These all together into a single numerical score.
This score was originally validated for Crohn's disease, but the study we are discussing today asked whether it could also predict inflammation in ulcerative colitis, where inflammation is limited and only involving superficial lining of colon, which is mucosa and submucosa.
Exactly. The researchers from the University Hospital Erlangen in Germany enrolled 58 patients with ulcerative colitis. Each patient underwent an intestinal ultrasound, and their IBIS SAS scores were compared with established clinical, endoscopic, histological, and biochemical markers, with things like the Mayo score, UCIS, Nancy index, CRP, and fecal calprotectin.
And the results were very encouraging. A cutoff of 15.9 on IBIS SAS score predict active disease on endoscopy with 100% sensitivity and 80% specificity. That means ultrasound detected all patients who actually had inflammation while correctly identifying most of those in remission.
Yes, and it's worth noting that the Limburg score, an older ultrasound score that considers bowel wall thickening and the Doppler signal, also performed well. However, the IBIS SAS slightly outperformed it, particularly to predict histologic inflammation.
Authors even proposed additional threshold of 38 for moderate and 69 for severe endoscopic disease activity. Those gradations could help clinicians monitor disease progression and response to treatment without always repeating endoscopy.
Yes, and the correlations were strong across the board, not just with endoscopy, but also with histology and biomarkers like CRP and fecal calprotectin. This reinforces that what we see on ultrasound really reflects what is happening in the tissue.
And of course, as Manuela said, there are certain limitations. This was a single-center study in a highly experienced unit. Sample size was very modest. So the next step would to validate study in multiple other centers with the diversity of the patients.
Still, this is a promising step toward using ultrasound as a routine objective measure in ulcerative colitis and not just in Crohn's disease. And honestly, if we can assess inflammation without scopes or sedation, that's a win-win for both doctors and patients.
Yes, exactly. That would mean fewer scopes, less prep, and it's important to move towards more patient-friendly monitoring, which is precise, standardized, and accessible.
So, to sum up, the IBIS SAS is a reliable, validated ultrasound score that correlates strongly with disease activity in ulcerative colitis. It could become a universal imaging tool for IBD if future studies confirm these results. And finally, we will look to a fresh new study that looks at how gluten exposure, both a single dose and 5 days of intake, affected gastrointestinal and psychological symptoms in two groups: people with self-reported non-celiac gluten sensitivity and the other group, healthy controls.
It was a randomized, single-blinded crossover trial done at Lubin in Belgium. Participants consumed 16 grams of gluten, about what most people eat daily, or a placebo made from whey protein, first as a one-time challenge mixed in yogurt and later as a daily muffin for 5 days.
During those periods, the researchers stressed not just only digestive symptoms like bloating and pain, but also fatigue, tension and mood, using validated psychological scales. They also measured biological markers, including CRP, intestinal permeability, and cortisol levels, to see if any physical changes accompanied the symptoms.
So what happened? Well, people with non-celiac gluten sensitivity did show higher fatigue after acute challenge and more bloating and abdominal pain after the 5-day phase. But here is the kicker. Those effects were not specific to gluten. They happened regardless of whether participants were taking gluten or placebo.
Right. There were no significant gluten by group interactions, meaning gluten itself did not stand as a cause. They also found that people with non-celiac gluten sensitivity had higher negative effects, that is, more negative mood and lower positive effect at baseline even before any gluten exposure.
And when they looked at biological marker, nothing changed. No difference in inflammation, cortisol or intestinal permeability, so no evidence of leaky gut or immune-related reaction from gluten.
So in short, the body didn't seem to react to gluten. However, the mind might have.
The author suggests that much of what's happening in non-celiac gluten sensitivity could be explained by nocebo's effect, which, when negative expectations cause real symptom, in fact, more than half of the pair participants reported symptoms during placebo that they attributed to gluten.
Yes, that's remarkable. And I think that these findings fit with other older studies, for example, the one published by De Graafs in 2023 that was a multi-center trial that showed that expectation alone can trigger gastrointestinal and psychological symptoms.
Exactly. So rather than seeing non-celiac gluten sensitivity as a pure gluten-driven condition, it might be more accurate to view it as a part of gut-brain axis where psychological, dietary and sensitive factors overlap.
The authors even suggest rethinking how we diagnose and manage non-celiac gluten sensitivity, integrating psychological evaluation and possibly cognitive behavioral therapy, especially exposure-based BCT, instead of just telling patients to avoid gluten forever.
Yes, this research helps refine how we think about gluten sensitivity, not dismissing it, but understanding it through a broader lens of gut-brain communication, and that's the key, moving from blaming gluten to understanding the person.
Exactly. Gluten may not be the villain after all. Maybe it's just the scapegoat in a bigger psychological story.
Thank you very much for joining us. So stay tuned for next cutting-edge episode for latest research in GI, been published in JUICI Journal. And please don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. Thank you very much.